allies, and anybody that wants to learn more about the LGBT plus community. My name is Zanardi, and I'm so glad all your beautiful faces are here.
Hello, beautiful people. Welcome back to the Alphabet Mafia podcast. I am so excited for you all to hear this episode. I learned so much. It's jam-packed with information about a full variety of subjects because our guest, Dana, is an amazingly well-rounded human. Dana is a trans woman and filmmaker here in Los Angeles. So we actually dive into the subject of Hollywood and filmmaking. We talk about her passion and process for making Blades. Those subjects cover about the first half of the episode. And then, of course, we dive deep into Dana's journey as a trans woman, the feelings she felt growing up in the Midwest, experiencing gender dysphoria throughout her life, and, you know, being in a place having absolutely zero recognition of trans people. We talk a lot about trans representation in media moving forward and how, for lack of better words, people like her want and will change the world. So I very much enjoyed this episode. Dana is a wonderful joy to talk to. So please enjoy this episode, gays, gals, non-binary pals. Welcome the great Dana St. Amand. Dana, thank you for coming on the show. I appreciate you being here.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So why don't you just tell the audience a little bit about yourself, introduce who you are.
All right. My name is Dana St. Amand. I am a trans woman. I am a professional filmmaker in L.A. I'm also a semi-pro blacksmith and bladesmith. Bladesmith. Blacksmith is the incorrect term.
Okay.
And we can talk about that a little bit and why that is the incorrect term, but yeah, for what I do.
For what you do. Okay.
But bladesmith.
Bladesmith. So what is the difference between a bladesmith and a blacksmith?
So as I understand it, and other smiths might have different definitions for it, and I don't know. As I understand it, a blacksmith is somebody who spends the majority of the time at the forge and at the anvil making tools, and like they're the ones who are making hammers for people. They're the ones who are making axes for people. They're the ones who are making all kinds of different tools that we use in the forge. But also traditionally speaking, they would be the ones who like made nails that would go and, you know, build houses. And they were the ones who would, I don't know that they did iron work historically, but I don't fully understand the definitions myself, and I'm in the community.
Sure.
You know? But a bladesmith is somebody who is only at the forge to create the blade. Mm. Like me, the bladesmithing process is much less the hammer and anvil, mm, and much more the fit and finish and fine tuning of the blade.
Okay.
So we deal a lot more with grinding metal and polishing metal and woodworking handle sections, mm, and we're practicing all of these different kinds of art forms, and they're much less that very structural blacksmithing technique that goes into the creation of tools.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. And I'm kind of picturing that blacksmith is a more broader term. They do a little bit more than where bladesmith is specifically the blade.
Right.
Aspect of it.
Yeah.
Blacksmiths can craft a little bit, as you said, axes or other types,
right,
of tools.
And like as a bladesmith, I can make axes. That's, mm-hmm, that is within my realm of experience. But
right,
I don't know if I made an axe, if I could call myself a blacksmith or not. But you know, I mean, blacksmith has become an overarching term. It's a very broad, generalized, mm-hmm, term. So, you know, while I try to use the correct terminology, if somebody calls me a blacksmith, I'm not necessarily going to correct them.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you're a bladesmith. What got you into that? Like, that's a very different passion, niche passion. Yes. I think you're the first bladesmith I've ever met. So
there's a surprising amount of us out there. And at least with the people I've interacted, the bladesmithing community is a very willing community to share experience and knowledge with. I've had a couple of other bladesmiths on my videos, specifically the ones where I'm like being outwardly queer, and they're thanking me for introducing the craft to a broader audience.
Mm.
It seems like a very wholesome a very wholesome craft community, which is really nice. But that wasn't your question. So I got started. I have always been a huge nerd. When I was a kid, it was going around with my brother and our neighbors, with sticks hitting each other and sword fighting. You know, anything was a weapon for us. I mean, we made bows in the backyard. We made crossbows out of coat hangers and rubber bands and shot skewers at each other. We weren't very safe. Honestly, I should have been injured a lot more as a child. But I've always been fascinated with like this medieval concept of knights and armor and swords. And I think, you know, subconsciously it was probably something along the lines of, well, back then you could really forge your own path. You could go your own way. Your journey was never set by any other standard. Hmm. So as I grew older, I mean, I got into Renaissance festivals and you know, games like the Elder Scrolls series.
Skyrim.
Oh, I started with Morrowind. Morrowind, then Oblivion, then of course I'm still replaying Skyrim over and over again because I'm a nerd.
We're waiting for the next one.
Oh, constantly. Yeah. I look up updates. I'm that kind of nerd. Where am I going with this? But you know, and then I got into college after I had graduated high school. Mind you, at this point I had already started my business, which we can talk about a little bit in when we get into the filmmaking side of myself.
Sure.
But I went to Kansas State University for mechanical engineering for a little bit, because I thought I was going to need, I mean, it's that whole idea of, you know, you need a real degree before you pursue your passions or whatever.
Sure, having something to fall back on.
Right, which, you know, is really, I'm so glad every day that I dropped out because I was not happy there.
Mm.
But, excuse me, when I was at K-State, I started fencing competitively. With their club. And that kind of solidified in my mind that, oh, this is something I want to be a part of my life.
Yeah.
And when I dropped out, I can't remember, it was after film school. It was after film school because I dropped out and then went to film school pretty quick. But after I graduated film school, I moved back to Kansas. And opened my studio, and finally had some free time on my hands. And my ADHD tends to make me hyperfixate on things. So one day I went down a rabbit hole of YouTube videos about bladesmithing, and hyperfixated on that. And like, I dived in. Oh, yeah. I dived in. I was hooked. I was hooked, hooked, hooked. And then I went out and built my first burner. No, it wasn't even a burner at that point. I was doing charcoal.
What's a burner?
A propane burner.
Okay.
So you need a special kind of propane burner to burn as hot as the propane can. Mm. You've got to have a specific fuel to air mixture to get to proper forging temperatures.
Okay.
But at that point I was using, we had a leaf blower in my dad's garage, in my parents' garage. I was living out of the house and had my studio, but my parents let me go home and blacksmith in their backyard. but I had a leaf blower and, a very rudimentary setup, for charcoal, for lump charcoal. And I think I made my first knife with a piece of mild steel that I found laying around our garage, a regular nail hammer, And I didn't have an anvil, so I used a rock.
Making do.
I mean, and I was hooked.
Yeah.
I was hooked.
That was the first piece of blade that you created.
And it was awful, but I was hooked.
Right. And that's the important part.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So it started with YouTube videos, really, or just that interest. And like, what does the process of a blade look like? Like, how do you get to a finished product from raw materials?
So a lot of that varies based on the preferences of the smith. For me, it's generally throw a hunk of metal in the fire, in the forge. Sometimes I will go without a design. Most of the time I will have a design that I'm working towards.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I just like the piece of material to tell me what kind of blade it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But the majority of the time, especially with commission work, I'm going off of a plan. So throwing that in there, getting the very rough shape of the blade out. And for me, it's very rough because the actual hammer and anvil part, I'm not the best at.
Sure.
I'm still learning.
Yeah.
I mean,
how long have you been doing this?
Off and on for 5 or 6 years.
Okay.
But quarantine has really, like, I've been in the workshop constantly because, you know, there's nothing else to do during COVID, which has been wonderful. And I've only just started taking commissions because of that.
Yeah. So do people order a piece from you, like pre-order, and then you make it designed how they want?
Pretty much. So they commission me, and I've got a double-digit list for commissions right now.
Whoa.
Which,
yeah,
I'm mind blown about that. People, like, I'm not a great smith. I mean, I think I'm good and I'm getting better, but I am not a great smith. So the fact that I have a commission line is incredible to me.
Does some of that come from TikTok, you think, and your success there?
Oh, all of it comes from TikTok.
All of it, yeah.
Literally all of it comes from TikTok. But so they will commission me, and I've got an artist's commission agreement that helps protect me and helps protect the client. If, like, for some reason I don't make their blade, they, you know, are protected.
Mm-hmm.
And that holds their spot in line. And then before I get started, I collect a 1/3 payment deposit as a materials upfront cost so that I can pay for the fuel for the forge and the raw materials and things of that nature. And then I work on the piece, I ship it out, and they pay the rest.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what's the general timeline for something? So you get an order in, let's say you can start that order next week. What is it? When is it finished?
It really depends on the piece.
Okay.
I just finished a knife that, when it was all said and done, took me 4 full 8-hour days, I would say, to create. And then there's packing and shipping time on top of that. This is a slow craft.
Yeah.
This is a time-consuming, very labor-intensive craft.
Well, it's a form of art.
Yeah.
Yeah. So... it's just like, you know, you're ordering a painting or getting something done like that. You expect it to take some time and have love poured into it by the artist.
Right. And there are times when, you know, I mean, I have the brand of ADHD where I am either hyper fixated on something or completely spaced out. There is no in between. So there are days that I just have to apologize to people because I cannot get my brain to work.
Sure.
Luckily people are receptive to that, and I think that's because I'm open and honest with them about that process.
Yeah.
No, it's not a speedy turnaround. It's not a speedy turnaround, especially if, I mean, there are times when something screws up in the process. I had to restart a broadsword commission recently because I was going through the process of smithing it out, and I discovered that there were stress fractures within the material, cracks within the steel. And there's really nothing you can do for that to keep that steel structurally sound. So
sure.
I had to start over.
Yeah. And take a loss, I assume.
Yeah. No, I'm not going to charge
right.
Hey, your first sword fucked up, you know, pay me more. No,
I take the loss for that, and I take the loss of time.
Yeah. And that happens, and that's something that, you, as a smith, you really have to roll with the punches, because otherwise your pieces will kick your ass.
Sure.
So you have to be very flexible and adaptive.
So let's talk about your whole process of a blade start to finish. What does that look like?
So if we have, if we're working off a design, we draw that out to proper dimensions. Like if I know that I want the blade thickness at the shoulders to be 3 or 4 millimeters, I'm going to plan that out. Again, sometimes I will work under the guy or under the influence of the steel, and the steel will just take me wherever it wants to go. And that's always just a fun process to see where it ends up. But yeah, if I'm working off of a design, it's very well, it's very thoroughly designed out, so I know where my measurements are. We throw that piece of steel in the forge, bring it up to temperature, hammer it out, and create a very, very, very rough blank for the blade. Then we take that and we grind it down to thicker than the final dimensions, and there's a reason for that. But we essentially shape the blade at the grinder. We grind in the profile of the blade, and we grind in the where our edge bevels are going to be, and we grind in the shoulders, and we get our blade to, I would say, like 80% of where it's going to end up. We want to leave it a little bit thick for the next process, because the next process is we take that blade, throw it back in the forge, we bring it up to critical temperature, which for steel, for high carbon steel that I'm using, I think is about 1600-1700 degrees Fahrenheit. Wow. We bring it actually a little past critical temperature. And we can tell by both looking at the color of the steel as it heats up, different colors persist. We can tell by looking at the colors of the steel, and also when it reaches critical temperature, it no longer is magnetic. So you can pull it out, take a magnet to it, and test to see your temperature.
Right.
You don't want to overheat the steel at this point. You don't want to underheat your steel at this point, because you're taking that hot, hot steel and you're quenching it in oil. That rapid cooling, when you heat up the steel to critical temperature, the molecules slightly separate, and they're reaching the point where they're separating and getting excited, like they're about to turn into a liquid. But they're still very solid. But they're reaching that point where they're kind of bouncing around a little bit. And then when you quench it quickly, they interlock and turn into a crystalline formation called martensite. And what that does is it makes the blade extremely, extremely hard, but incredibly brittle.
Oh.
It's a lot like glass.
Okay.
You take a sharp edge of glass, that edge will persist for a very long time, and you can slash the hell out of anything.
Yeah.
But you throw that glass against the ground and it shatters.
Right.
Same thing happens with that steel. I've had a lot of swords break on me, a lot of blades break on me at this point, because clumsy hands, or, I mean, the most recent was the rapier that I worked on that I showed TikTok, and it fell out of my tongs.
Oh no.
And shattered on the ground at this point. Oh. And I had already put in a couple weeks of work on that.
Yeah.
But after that, you take that steel, that very brittle steel, and you do a process called tempering, which what it's doing is you heat the steel back up slowly to about 400, 450, depending on the steel, the alloy that you're using. And what that does is it takes those molecules, those tightly interlocked molecules, and just starts to separate them just a bit to where you find this nice balance of ultra hardness and flexibility.
Mm.
So it's hard enough to keep an edge, but it's not going to shatter on you.
Right.
It has edge retention, but it also has the ability to bend and then come back straight.
And is that kind of in its final form?
After that point, after that point, you do the final grind on it. So you bring it to its final proportions, you bring it to its final finish. And then you can do all the fittings, like the handle and whatever guard you're using.
Mm.
So it's a very long time consuming process to even get to the point where you can see the blade as it's going to be.
Sure. So your other passion is filmmaking.
Yes.
And anyone in that industry knows there's also lots of failures there.
So, oh boy, are there.
Yeah. Why don't you talk about what got you into that? But now you have your own studio and you are working with some popular people in filmmaking or in that production.
Yeah.
So what drove you to filmmaking?
So it really got started. My interest in it started again when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And again with my siblings, because my sister and my brother would, and some of our neighbors, we were making Star Wars and Indiana Jones movies as kids when I was like 6 years old. We were running around the backyard making dumb little home movies
on the little video camera with the screen that pops out.
On the little tapes, and we would take that tape camera and hook it up to a VHS VCR and like hit record on the VCR real quick, right as we hit play on the specific take we wanted.
Yeah.
And then hit stop real quick and then find the new take on the camera and hit record on the, I mean, we were editing. We were inline editing on a VHS tape when we were kids. But you know, I had a vague fascination, with it, and it's funny now I look back. My sister had to be the director because, you know, older siblings.
Mm-hmm.
She had to write it. She had to direct it. But she was only getting wide shots. And I remember as a kid, I didn't think of it in these words, but I remember it as a six-year-old thinking, relaying it to what I was watching on TV and thinking, well, why are we just getting wide? Why aren't we going in for close-ups?
Right.
Where's our other shots? So I had already, at six, my mind was already kind of working that way.
Those wheels were turning.
Yeah. And then, you know, I made some stuff with friends growing up, but it really got going at 16 when my brother died by suicide.
Mm. And
thank you. I was 16 and didn't know how to process that. And of course I was still very closeted too. So I didn't understand a lot of what was going on with myself. I didn't understand how to process a lot of the emotions from that loss. And it was a couple months later in that summertime, I had nothing to do and I was really down. So I picked up a camera and made something.
Mm-hmm.
Picked up a camera and made something in a day. Start to finish, edit it, and put it on YouTube. These don't exist on YouTube anymore, of course.
Like, where can I find this?
But, you know, and then the next day I did the same thing. Then the next day I did the same thing. And then the next day I did that for like a month.
Wow.
Of just creating something every single day.
And it was fulfilling, right? Like obviously.
It was therapeutic.
Yeah.
I didn't understand. I was making really dumb, like, I don't even know how to describe them. They were not good. But it was a way for me to express what I could not express as a person, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Totally. And from there, I started making more and more serious things. In that year, I had started to turn that into a little bit of what would eventually become my production company. Mm. I was doing real estate videos at 16. Some real estate agent hired a 16-year-old to go shoot houses, which, you know, isn't much, but as a 16-year-old, I thought it was great.
Yeah, of course.
And then it grew from there. And when I was at K-State for engineering, I was a photojournalist for the K-State Collegian, the newspaper there.
Mm.
Excuse me. And then when I dropped out, I immediately got a job on the first movie I ever worked. A filmmaker by the name of Steve Balderson, who grew up and at the time was living in Wamego, Kansas, was making one of his features.
Whoa.
And I got hired on that.
What's the feature?
It was a feature called Occupying Ed.
Okay.
And Steve Balderson is a gay filmmaker himself. So Occupying Ed, well, I won't get into sure. That's a whole nother tangent.
Sorry. Go ahead. Or you get into this movie, you get to work on it.
Yeah.
And how does that translate into your next steps? And does it inspire, like, whoa, this is what I want to do?
It was incredibly inspiring. I worked with, so I got hired on as just a production assistant. You know, any kid can be a PA. Good PAs are hard to come by, but like starting PAs are generally, you know, very green to sets.
Are PAs the people that, like, do the coffee and make sure no one's cell phone's going off and stuff like that? Or is there more?
Stuff like that. Okay. There is more to their jobs, right. But, you know, this was the only time I ever PA'd, so I don't feel comfortable talking about a position that I'm not
sure
wholeheartedly involved in. But yeah, by the end, it was such a small crew in Kansas that this could happen, but by the end of the first week, I was no longer the PA. I was the first assistant camera.
Wow.
And I was the first AC for a guy by the name of Daniel Stevens, who is just one of the nicest cinematographers I've ever worked with. And he taught me so much on that set. He taught me the basis of what I know for how to properly light a scene, how to really choose your angles to tell your story, things that I had been thinking about, but that had never been presented to me verbally before.
Yeah.
I developed an understanding for the communication that happens on set.
Yeah.
And after that movie, I worked for this little tiny media company in town for a little bit, made my first movie, and then went to film school.
Whoa. So you were on you got this first feature while in college or while studying, engineering.
Literally right after I had dropped out.
Okay.
So I wasn't in school anymore, but it happened right away.
Right.
Which is neat.
Yeah. And then you're like, fuck it, I need to go to film school.
Oh, my mom. I was ready to just be like, you know what, screw it. I'm gonna do my own thing. I'm gonna make this work.
Yeah.
Because that seems to be the type of person I am. my mom wasn't having that though. She thought I needed to go to school for it. And she found this little tiny film school in Detroit, or Troy, which is a suburb of Detroit. Called the Motion Picture Institute of Michigan. And it's a year-long program, film specific. You go, you don't get a degree, but you get a certificate in whatever focus you want. They did just get accredited, but they weren't accredited when I attended.
Gotcha.
But I went to film school for a year and I got certified, I guess. I got certificates in screenwriting and directing, but during my time there, I was one of the go-to camera operators because I was the only one who had been shooting since I was 16.
Yeah.
So I came out of there with a knowledge of pretty much every aspect of filmmaking.
And did you find that that was definitely, I guess, let me package this question in a more easier way to unpack. What do you find most, I guess it kind of also depends now, but is being on set and learning that, is that more beneficial, or is the school aspect almost a necessary thing for anyone trying to pursue film? Like, where do you find more value?
It's very much dependent on how a person learns. Mm-hmm. If somebody works better and learns better in a classroom setting, film school is a no-brainer. I am a very visual learner. I mean, I taught myself how to bladesmith from YouTube videos and my own research. I am a very visual and motivated doer learner. I learn by doing and I learn by watching. So for me, it's more beneficial to learn from set. Mm-hmm. Now, MPI was a very hands-on school, so I did get that out of it.
Right.
But it's very much at the discretion of an individual. Nobody in this industry really cares if you've gone to film school or not, as long as you know what you're doing.
Sure.
And there are so many different avenues of learning this craft already. I mean, you can teach yourself everything you need to know from YouTube videos. Film Riot is a great resource. Film Riot is a channel on YouTube. Mm. DSLR Video Shooter is a wonderful resource. Cinema 5D, all of these are on YouTube. Hell, take a couple of master classes.
Yeah.
And if you are that kind of learner, you'll get everything that you would have gotten in film school out of it. The good benefit of film school, though, is you come out with connections to people that you know how to work with.
Sure.
My personal opinion would be to shy away from like a 4-year university, because that's too much money.
Yeah. And time even.
And time. Yeah. But you go to like, hell, if you even go to a couple of workshops a year and you meet people and you find people who are like-minded and work well with you, and you can start growing your team and growing your network. Mm. This industry is such a social industry. I am rarely hired because of a resume. Mm. I am so frequently hired because I'm a friend of a friend, or because one of my buddies is making something and needs a cinematographer. Those kind of connections, you know, you build your team and you build your atmosphere in the independent film community. If you're an asshole, you're not going to get hired.
Yeah.
So you've also
look at that.
Right. You also just have to be a kind person. So I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with that, but that's you know.
That makes total sense. There's so much online now. I mean, you can learn anything on YouTube. Like, I mean, you learn sword making. You can learn filmmaking. You can learn about real estate and how to save money and things like that. Like, there's anything you want you can find on YouTube, which is weird because it's like shifting our perception of school.
Yeah.
Like it really is. And the 4-year degree, it's so expensive now. Like, why would I go if you can learn anything on YouTube? So.
Now, well, yes. And no, I mean, like, I wouldn't.
Well, you can't become a doctor on YouTube.
Right? Yeah. Like,
anything that's not STEM, I feel like, has.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose if there were, like, certain criterias that need to be met, like, okay, if I went into a job interview and I didn't have a 4-year degree, but maybe I had shown that I had trained some other way and then taken a standard test, not a true standardized test, because we all know how those suck, but, you know, like, an example would be the bar for lawyers, right. You know, how they have to take that test. It would be like, I'm not saying we should do this for lawyers, but like if we got rid of law school completely,
yeah,
or made law school an option,
right,
and they could study and study and study and study and then just go take the bar. And if they pass, they've shown that they, you know, maybe that is like a future that we should strive for, where people who don't learn well in a classroom can still prosper, can still go after what they need to. Because honestly, that was me.
Yeah.
I did okay in school, but especially with undiagnosed ADHD, you know, at that point in my life, not being out, I was had major depression, anxiety disorders, and didn't understand that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't focus well in a classroom environment. But if I put my mind on something I wanted to learn, I could do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially if you're, it's something that you like are passionate about.
Right.
It's all out there. And I totally agree. Like having some type of standardized test like the bar that a lawyer can take or a potential lawyer can take, and they prove that they know enough, like throw them in there.
Right.
give them the law title.
You'd have to, like, there are flaws with that logic, of course, that would need to be sussed out, but there would just be, I don't know, I feel like if schooling was never built for people like me, schooling was never built for non-neurotypical people.
Sure. And I also have ADHD. I was diagnosed, I think, my sophomore year of high school. So, very similar learning experience. Like I did not do well in classrooms. I don't do well in classrooms, but, you know, when I focus on something and learn and consume it in a way that is more fitting for me, specifically videos, you know, it does help a lot more with retaining information.
Right. So,
yeah. It needs to be, something needs to happen to shake up the learning system because it wasn't built for us. And people are, so many people are different. So many people learn different ways, and putting it all in a one size fits all is just not working out.
Right. And on the subject of ADHD, the amount of undiagnosed ADHD in women is, I mean, it's incredible because the people look at mostly male ADHD as that bouncing off the wall, very high energy ADHD.
Yeah.
And then they look at my type of ADHD, and I find this so fascinating as a trans person that I have the type of ADHD that cis women have, which shows me that I am exactly where I need to be.
Yeah.
But the type of ADHD that is prevalent in cis women is the type I have, very space out or hyper focus. Mm-hmm. It gets misdiagnosed as depression more often than not. So
do you have thoughts on why that is, that it gets misdiagnosed? Is it just a shortcoming in our healthcare system or in our psychological diagnosis? Or
I think it's a shortcoming in understanding more than anything. And I do think it is, I don't know that I have, that I'm the one to speak on that.
Sure. That makes sense. Did you want to add anything to the ADHD thing? I thought, as it kind of cut you off, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I don't really have much else. we just need to, like, we need better methods of, I mean, I'm a huge advocate of mental health. Having my own, you know, mental health journey and non-neurotypical journey. And, of course, having my brother's death. Mm-hmm. I am a fierce advocate for mental health practices, and I do believe that we need to have much, much stronger infrastructures for mental health in schools.
Yeah.
At a young age, so that things like ADHD and high functioning autism and different things that are going to make a child's life make it more challenging for them to learn in that environment can be noticed in the beginning, so that they can get into a classroom where they can learn the way they learn,
right,
and aren't held back because the system doesn't cater to them.
Yeah. Well, speaking on your mental health journey and going through all that, when I guess let's start, when did you first come out as transgender?
When I was 23.
You were 23.
Mm-hmm.
And when did that, when would you say that journey started for you?
At birth.
At birth.
100% at birth.
When did you first start to realize consciously, wait a second, what's going on? What am I, why do I feel different?
Some of my earliest memories at 3 years old.
3 years old.
3 years old. Now, this is my journey.
Yes.
Not every trans person understands. And every trans person has, there's this narrative that a lot of people push on behalf of cis people understanding us.
Mm.
Is that, you know, oh, I knew when I was 3 years old, I just didn't have the words for it. And, you know, I'm guilty of saying that.
Sure.
Because it's a very clear cut, concise story that we can give people. But the truth is, it was a struggle, and it was a push and a pull and a constant mental battle of, why am I feeling this way? Why is this happening? Why do I feel comfortable like this, but not like this? It was a battlefield.
Yeah.
So even though I will give occasionally a cookie cutter answer of, I knew when I was 3 years old that I was more comfortable in women's clothing, the truth is that was a landmine
mm-hmm.
within a battlefield.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Totally. Was it, every day, was it just like, what did it feel like, I guess? In your words, what can you describe this battlefield and navigating this minefield?
Well, it's interesting because I have a type of dysphoria known as dissociative dysphoria, where I kind of disassociate from my body.
Mm.
Or I did before I transitioned. I still do occasionally, and that's just part of dysphoria.
Yeah.
Where you don't feel connected to your body. It's just kind of a means to an end. It's just kind of there.
Right.
But I also have disassociation from my personality in the same regard.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of feelings that I can't quite pinpoint in my childhood.
Sure.
There's a lot of things in my life that I just don't feel connected to. Like, for example, I'm an Eagle Scout.
Yeah.
I remember going through the process of becoming an Eagle Scout, but I don't feel connected to that accomplishment. I don't feel connected to the things that I did.
Right.
And
is this something that the majority of trans people face? Is this something that we see commonly in trans people that after they transition, that previous identity is not there, it's not connected to them?
I cannot speak on that.
Okay.
I can only speak to my own personal experiences.
Sure.
With that, and with my own personal experiences identifying it as disassociative mm-hmm. Dysphoria.
Okay.
So I can't speak to that. I can
sure. I didn't know if like you knew you could pull statistics out or something, but
no. Okay. I would be interested to know, but it's not mm-hmm. something that I think has been studied widely
mm-hmm.
because it was only recently. I mean, we had the gender dysphoria umbrella as a way for cis people to describe trans people. For so long.
Yeah.
And it was a requirement that you had to go in there and you had to get diagnosed with gender dysphoria in order for you to get hormones and actually become who you are. Not become who you are, but change your body to reflect who you are.
Right.
And now, thankfully, it's looking like the psychology community is moving and we're getting other terms like dissociative dysphoria is one of those terms that is popping up.
So is gender dysphoria, is this kind of like a old school term that we shouldn't be saying anymore, that like is kind of not a true reflective of what happens in many trans people?
I think it's still a valid form of expressing what we go through.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, you know, a lot of people will use the argument of you can't be trans if you don't have dysphoria as a way to gatekeep people, especially for like non-binary trans people,
right.
Agender trans people, or people who decide not to transition medically. And that's been an issue within our own community. The trans medicalist community is strong, and the trans medicalist community is essentially saying, if you're not in such a state of dysphoria that you don't want to change your body, you're not trans enough. And that is bullshit.
Yeah.
I say that as somebody who has medically transitioned, who has had bottom surgery, who, you know, plans on continuing my hormones for the rest of my life. I say that as somebody who has medically transitioned, that that idea is bullshit and it is harmful to the entire trans community.
Mm. How would somebody, maybe you can answer this, I don't know, because again, it's your own experiences, but how would somebody that doesn't experience gender dysphoria know they're trans? Is it, what yeah, I guess, can you answer that? Is there substance to it?
It's tricky because, you know, I am not a non-binary person. Right. I am a trans woman. So I feel very strongly that I identify as a woman. But for a, like, trans non-binary person, for them to, I would imagine, and with my conversations with non-binary people, excuse me, it seems like their journey is a struggle to figure out not only where they fit in within themselves, but where they fit in terms of labeling. A lot of non-binary people struggle with wanting to call themselves trans because, well, I'm not medically transitioning or anything like that. And I mean, to those people who, anybody listening to this, if you're non-binary and you're not planning on transitioning medically, you're still part of us.
Yeah.
You're still within our group because as I understand it, the new modern thinking for psychologists is gender incongruence rather than gender dysphoria, where you feel an incongruency between your assigned gender at birth.
Okay. You grew up in the Midwest.
Yes.
And growing up in that type of environment in the 90s is like, for a trans person, that's got to be a little scary. Or did you feel like there was no representation? Like, what did that feel like to you growing up in an area like that?
It was very, it was not a good place if you were an other. And that got suppressed. I don't have conscious remembrance of this. But when I had started having that struggle within myself at 3 years old, something told me that I needed to push that down, that I needed to squash that because I was going to be ostracized in this community. Something told me that that was not okay, quote unquote.
Right.
And I think that's where a bulk of my struggle has come from, is that own internalized transphobia that has, that was inlaid in me from that community. And the fact that we just didn't have education for it, we didn't have words to describe it. I didn't see, you know, I didn't watch a lot of TV growing up, but even with the TV that I did watch, there was nobody, presenting as themselves as a trans person. I mean, I remember running around the playground in like sixth grade making fun of people because, I mean, we had probably heard our parents joking about it and didn't understand it ourselves, but we were running around screaming, haha, you got a sex change, you got a sex change, oh, that's weird, you got a sex change, ew. And not understanding the true implications of that. And that persists in that gestates in that ferments into hatred and fear of the unknown as we get older and older and older. It took, when I was 23 years old, I had to look up a definition of transgender. Mm. And then it clicked. If I had looked up that definition years earlier, I wonder what would have happened.
Yeah. I mean, at 23 to have to go to Google and look that up versus being at 8 years old and seeing a trans character on your favorite cartoon show, like night and day in terms of those years in between.
Yeah.
And what you were struggling with through those years.
Right. Which is why I try to be so vocal about who I am. I mean, one, because trans people, we shouldn't need to be vocal about who we are. We are allowed to just exist,
right,
as people.
Yes.
I know that I am tenacious enough and powerful enough that I can take transphobic comments and I can be an active voice within our community.
Mm-hmm.
For those who don't want to or don't otherwise feel comfortable to.
Right.
So that's why I am comfortable being a big trans presence for younger generations to see, for people who are struggling to see. I mean, I try to show just how joyful of a person I am, because trans joy is an act of resistance and should be shown and should be celebrated.
Absolutely. 100%. Do you plan to ever kind of cross your passions and activism work? And do you ever plan to do movies or television that combines your sword making and your love for the medieval times, but also with this love for filmmaking and representation for the trans community? Do you have any like projects in your mind that float around like that?
Oh yeah. I'm working on a script right now for a short that I want to shoot if I can get funding, which, you know, is always the issue.
Sure.
But I can't say much, but it's, you know, medieval lesbian, forbidden lesbian love story. Let's say that.
I'll already buy my ticket.
And I'm really excited about it. And I hope people want to see it enough to, I don't know, maybe I'll do a GoFundMe or something for that.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I mean, if I go the traditional routes to studios and such, nobody's going to buy that movie.
Mm.
None of the studios out here, unless I go to an LGBT-specific studio, which very few exist.
Right.
Nobody's going to give money for that because they don't think it'll sell. They don't think it'll do well.
Do you think that industry's changing at all? Do you think that we're seeing, especially with just the rise of Black Lives Matter and this like kind of crazy mass awakening of consciousness that we've seen the last few months, do you think that we're going to get more progressive work like that and others in the mainstream soon?
I hope so.
Mm.
I think, in my honest opinion, is I think the studio system is going to resist.
Mm.
They're going to want to keep the status quo because that's what makes them money or has made them money in the past.
Yeah.
And I do think what we are going to see is a rise in independent content.
Mm.
Stuff like mine. I've got a short film that I need to finish up and release about the trans experience from a personal perspective.
Yeah.
I also have a TV show coming out to OutTV called Translation, where it's a roundtable talk with trans women who they were all four contestants on RuPaul's Drag Race and then transitioned afterwards. Mm. And that'll be on OutTV soon. I don't have a release date for that. they haven't told me, but. So I think there is going to be a rise in representative independent projects.
Right.
And I'm hopeful that they will take over.
Yeah.
I am hopeful that, I mean, honestly, I just want to abolish the studio system myself, but I want to abolish a lot of things. You know, like
start with the police.
Start then with the police.
Studio system.
Studio system can come later. We need to abolish the police now.
ACAP.
ACAB motherfuckers. Well, that's actually something we can talk about, is like why, as queer people, we're also so adamant about defunding the police and such. Yeah. But I can say, I can bring this statistic up as a trans woman in this country. If an officer figures out that I am a trans person, I am 7 times more likely to experience police brutality in an encounter.
Wow.
That's nowhere near what people of color and Black people experience, but it is still significantly higher.
Yeah.
It's 7 times higher than the average American.
Yeah.
So, like, I've had people ask me, like, oh, why are you so adamant about defund the police, and why are you so active in BLM? Well, it's because it does. I mean, one, it's the right thing to do, mm-hmm. is to be involved in this movement and to help our brothers and sisters and non-binary siblings work through this. But also, it directly affects me as well.
Yeah.
It shouldn't have to direct me for me to be involved, but it happens to also affect me.
Right. I didn't know that trans people are 7 times more likely to be victims of police brutality. That's
right.
A new statistic for me, so thank you for...
I do need to corroborate that statistic. It's been a while since I looked that statistic up. However, that was the last one that I saw.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are your... When you read the news and you see that 25 trans women have been harmed this past year alone, what do we do? Like, what can we do?
I have panic attacks for my trans siblings. I have honest to God panic attacks when I see headlines like that. And it's never necessarily for me. I know I am in a good environment where I am. Mm-hmm. And I know that I carry knives with me.
Yeah.
And I know how to use them. You know, I'm never safe, but I can defend myself if need be.
Sure.
I have panic attacks for my friends, mm-hmm. who aren't as capable of defending themselves. I have panic attacks for my entire community, who is constantly ostracized, who's constantly unappreciated and just not understood. And I think that's what it comes down to, is understanding.
Yeah.
Because when I came out in Kansas, I owned my little photo and video studio. And people stopped doing business with me. Enough people stopped doing business with me that I had to close my doors.
Wow.
But of the people who were iffy about me, the people who actually sat down and talked to me, I was able to explain things to them and they developed more empathy for me.
Mm.
So it was the people who just refused to talk, refused to learn, who made me close my doors.
It's people who are willfully ignorant.
Yeah. It's the people who just are terrified of the unknown. And that's all it is. It's fear.
Yeah.
Fear turns into hatred. Fear turns into oppression.
Yeah. We could quote Star Wars a little bit there.
Yeah.
Hate turns to fear.
Fear turns into hate. Hate turns into suffering.
Yeah. That's it.
But I do think it all comes down to education. Why I think whoever introduced the idea of LGBT teaching, LGBT history, is, I would have fucking loved to hear about the Stonewall riots when I was in school.
Yeah.
Because it's rad as hell.
Yeah.
I mean, the more we can broaden our curriculum to include all aspects of human life.
Right.
The good, the bad, the ugly, and the wonderful.
Right. History and social studies should be just that, a broad picture of every type of person.
Right.
Every social being there is. Like, instead we learn about fucking Christopher Columbus, who murdered thousands of people and raped them and
was, you know, a genocidal asshole. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We learned about him for a month in school instead of other things that humans are more connected to.
Right. Like, did you know how I actually can't speak on that. I'm not enough of a history nerd.
Sure.
But, like, let's go back to my definition thing of when I was coming out. If I had had that definition to speak when I was a child, who knows how different my life would be.
Right.
If the people that I was running around on the playground with, if we had that definition and that proper representation to show, would we still be making those dumbass jokes? Would we still be cultivating that same sense of different?
Yeah.
It all comes down to education and awareness, in my opinion.
100%.
People become more empathetic to what they understand.
Absolutely. And that's one of the main motivations behind this podcast, is to get a variety of voices from all backgrounds of life, from all skin colors, from all socioeconomic statuses, so that people can hear them and can hear what they go through and what they feel. And hope, even if just turning one person who is ignorant into someone who understands, or at least attempts to understand, and that, you know, it's a win for me. It's
right.
I've done my job if just one person can listen and hear.
Right.
I recently watched The Danish Girl for the first time. For anyone listening, it's a story of a trans woman in the 1920s who is married to a cisgendered woman, and it explores her transition into becoming a woman. And I had a few thoughts on it. You know, I was watching it, but I want to hear kind of your perspective from a trans woman. How did this movie portray the trans woman community in a broad sense?
Sure. So I can only, of course, can only speak from my experience.
Sure.
And I do not mean to speak for the entire trans community.
Sure.
With anything that I do. That being said, I am one of the people who does believe that right now, at least, cis people should not play trans people.
Mm.
And the reasoning behind that is there are so many, so many wonderful trans actresses who would have portrayed that role to a T.
Mm.
And you can go back and forth with people on, well, it's acting, it's a character. Well, it depends on your definition of character. In my opinion, trans is not a character. Trans is who I am.
You're right.
But ultimately, what it comes down to, I believe, is we're still being murdered, and we still have harm coming to us. We need to be the center voice to our own revolution.
Mm.
Movies like this kind of feel like it's Hollywood throwing us a bone, saying, hey, look, we made a trans movie, now we can go and do all this other shitty stuff.
Right.
They're throwing a cis person in the role to get away with telling a trans story, in my opinion.
Mm.
And maybe we can reach a point someday where trans stories can be told by whoever. But when it's a matter of we need proper representation now in order for us to get to a better place, we're not at that point.
Right.
Does that make sense?
No, totally. I definitely hear where you're coming from, and I understand it. And I don't necessarily have thought, like, that's a different thing, like the trans representation. I have my own thoughts because, you know, you see in like Love, Victor, or Love, Simon, it's a straight actor playing those characters. And I don't have a hard stance on it. It's not a hill I'm going to die on. But it's like, yes, I would love to see a gay actor play Simon in Love, Simon, right? But also I understand that it's like, it's a business and there's auditions. And I kind of like, if if Nick Robinson, the actor who played him, was the best actor in the audition and is going to play this character the best, then maybe give him the role. Like, but again, it's not a hill I'm going to die on. And it's different, I think. And
it is different because gay men especially have been at the forefront of, like, marriage equality was cis gay people.
Mm-hmm.
And trans people are still very much fighting. And I know there's so much oppression that still happens in the gay and lesbian community. I'm not trying to deny that at all.
Mm-hmm.
However, what I am saying is that it's a more mainstream concept that is more generally broadly accepted.
Right.
And when I believe the last statistic I saw is that as a white trans woman, I can walk out and have a 1 in 12 chance of experiencing harm.
Wow.
At the hands of another person. I think it turns into 1 in 8 if you were a trans person of color.
Wow.
Especially a trans woman of color.
Yeah.
When we are still going through that kind of active violence against us, the conversation about representation changes a little bit.
Totally.
And again, I do think that we can get to the point where whoever's best for the role should get the role.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, I do think we are very much in the point where that is not the end all be all. Representation matters right now.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. Like if a trans actor or actress was up there accepting an Oscar for that role or nominated for that role, like that, even just seeing that in the headlines or in the newspaper, trans actor, actress is nominated for an Oscar. Like it's there. It's representation. It's real. Yeah. And I don't think that's happened before, right?
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah.
I'd love to be proven wrong, though.
Yeah. Or in a few years, I'll see. So, aside from the issue with the representation in this movie, how did you feel it portrayed the journey of a trans woman? Because when I saw it, when I watched it, you know, I thought it was an okay film, and it was cookie cutter. It was a little strange, at least from my point of view, because you see, I'm going to say the actor's name, because I forget the character's name, but Lily's the female after transitioning, and then I think Elnor was, or Anor, anyway, so you see Eddie Raymond, the actor, he puts on a dress for his wife's portrait that she's painting. And it's like you have this whole cinematic moment where it's telling you this is his realization that he's trans, but it's like a very like one quick like little click that happens. And I feel like that is, there's more substance to most trans people's journeys than like a singular moment, or is that a misinterpretation?
Oh, at least for me, you're right on the money. At least for my personal transition, it's a lifetime of discovery.
Yeah.
Of what makes you feel comfortable and what doesn't.
Yeah.
I mean, I was dressing appropriately at 3 years old and not understanding why I felt comfortable like that.
Right.
You know, before I came out at 23, I genuinely thought, well, maybe I'm just a straight drag queen. Those exist, right? Maybe I'm just a straight drag queen. I can do that, right? Like, that's the kind of thought process that went through my head, at least.
Right.
So I really think the Danish Girl, it was very much told from a cis perspective.
Yeah.
It was made for cis people.
Yeah.
It was not made for trans people. Because... oh, honey, if I had made that movie, we would have dived into what made me uncomfortable, what made them uncomfortable, what, you know, what little facets, what, like, oh, wearing jeans today is comfortable and fine, but wearing jeans the other day is the worst thing in the fucking world, so I'm going to put on sweatpants for the next 3 years. true story.
How many pairs of sweatpants do you have?
Oh, I used to have a lot. I mean, so I do think that's one of the, I mean, I don't want to like, I don't just want to shut this movie down, because it in its own flawed way, it is representation for our community.
Sure.
And at least,
I didn't know this was going to be this difficult.
When it comes to the media,
yeah,
and how the media portrays trans people, the entire LGBT community, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we kind of get thrown the scraps and get whatever we want.
Well, what happens is these studios and these producers, they'll push out a bold idea, a concept that's
Bold idea, we've existed since the beginning of time.
Exactly. They'll put out, we haven't had this $90 million film about a trans person before, and they'll come for the awards. They will make the film with one thing on their mind, and that's an Academy Award.
Right.
And to do that, they make it as broadly appealing as possible, as cookie cutter, so that your grandma can go and see the film and be like, wow, that was very moving. But they don't have a full idea of the trans community or the gay community or whatnot.
Yeah.
And that needs to change. And so going back to we wish that studios will defund the studios.
Defund the police, defund the studios.
That's going on a shirt now. I
defund the prison industrial complex.
Yes. Period. Just a list of everything to defund.
Defund university sports teams.
Oh my gosh. So I have this idea that the studios can't, because right now, the past 5-10 years, yes, independent filmmaking has been squashed out. It's been squashed out because the only people that get funding are the studios are making Avengers, or if you're making a blockbuster movie, you're going to get the funding because those are the only movies that are being seen in theaters, and it pushed out independent filmmaking.
Right.
But with this Corona thing, it's interesting because the theaters have gone away, and what you're seeing is you see big studio releases come straight to streaming,
right?
And they're like $30, right? So the whole family can gather and watch the Avengers for $30, but if we're releasing these smaller independent films, we can set a lower price on a lower budget film, right? Theoretically, right? If we're talking straight to streaming services, which is something that hasn't really happened before, because you go to the theater and it's $15 to see Avengers, $15 for the small independent film.
Right.
But if, are you following me? That if we can like release these smaller and at scale to what their price could be, then
we can take over the industry.
Yeah.
Now, the only issue with that is, I mean, that has to come from independent movies that are already finished.
Mm.
Right now, film production is pretty much halted across the board. I mean, like, we've got protocol in place for proper COVID procedures on set, but it's still a huge risk to even just go on set. I say, as somebody who's about to go shoot a music video this weekend, it's going to be a risk, and I'm going to need to isolate myself afterwards for a little bit because I'm going to be working around people.
Yeah.
But
do they offer testing?
Not at least not for this, in this tiny one that I'm about to do. But I know like the studios can afford to, they can afford to hire out their crew, have them isolate for 2 weeks beforehand in a hotel, have them tested every day, and then get them on set. Studios can pay for that. Right. Independent filmmakers can't.
Right.
So I think for a long time, we're either, independent filmmakers out there are either going to risk their health and safety to make projects, or we're just not going to make anything except for stuff by ourselves.
Yeah.
So yes, you're right that the industry is changing a little bit, but I don't want to be cynical about it. But I do believe that independent filmmakers are still going to be struggling right now.
Sure. At least for the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
But I don't know, this business model of streaming kind of piqued my interest, because I was like, well, if you can set different prices for different movies, you can proportionate it based on budgeting.
Right.
Which in theory would work and prop up independent films. But you're right, the production is halted. That's where the roadblock is.
Yeah. So, I mean, we could do that with movies that, independent movies that we've already made or that are in post right now. Like, I plan on doing that with my little short film when I finally finish it.
Yeah.
And I'm doing all of the post production work for that. Wow. And I've already got a full workload in the smithy. So I'm doing two businesses at once. Yeah. And on top of that, you know, TikTok and Queer Collective and I'm stretching myself thin. I need a personal assistant that I can't afford.
Right. Don't we all at some point?
Yeah. But like, I plan to do that with my little movie is release it during this time of lockdown.
Yeah.
So that hopefully more people can see it. And then that comes back to a point of representation, because it's a trans movie.
Yeah.
And hopefully that broadens a little bit of representation for people.
Totally agree. Do you want to talk about are you able to talk about the plot at all, or give any little
teasers? My movie?
Yes. What we can expect?
No.
No? Okay.
I will say, like, it's a coming out story, which I know we need. There's a reason I made this coming out story a short film.
Mm-hmm.
Because I am of the mindset that we don't need more coming out stories.
Yeah.
We need stories of LGBT people existing in the world regularly.
Yeah.
As themselves, as they are, in all of their joy.
Right.
However, for my own process and my own mental health, since filmmaking is so therapeutic for me, mm-hmm. I felt the need to make this coming out story.
You needed to tell your story.
I needed to tell it. So I wanted to make it a short, just like, okay, I'm going to make this.
Yeah.
I'm going to do this for my therapy. Mm-hmm. It's going to exist, and then I will move on.
Right. That's what happens in art. It bursts out of you. Like, it gets to a point where you're like, I need to make this. I need to tell this story. I need to express these emotions, and it happens.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the lead is one of my friends, who is a wonderful trans woman.
Hmm.
And I only know, like, I don't know what she wants to go by on her stage name. Okay. So, which is why I'm not saying her name, but she's a wonderful actress who plays the lead. And it's a very quiet, intimate story, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Is how I would describe it.
Do you have any closing advice for anyone listening that might have been in a similar position as you when you were younger?
Trust your gut. Trust what makes you comfortable, and explore what makes you feel comfortable. If you don't have a gut feeling, and if you don't know what makes you feel comfortable, feel free to explore.
Mm-hmm.
Because you will find something that makes you feel comfortable or something that makes you feel uncomfortable. And understanding how you interact and understand yourself and your existence in this world is the most powerful, liberating thing that you can do.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. where can people find you? What's your TikToks and your website?
my TikTok is at Dana is trans, you know, very straightforward, directly to the point. My Instagram is linked off of there, but it's Dana _ST_AMAND, which is just my last name. And then my website is www.dana, Dana,
Saint Amand, no period, all DANASTAMAND.com. That period in my last name fucks everything up.
It's a very fitting name, because it's when I hear anytime there's a saint in a name, it reminds me just like the medieval times, or like those, like that side of the world, that type of history, and now you make swords.
Yeah, and it's a French name, so like Saint Amand is the Midwest pronunciation that we go by. I mean, every time, my whole family is Louisiana Cajun.
Okay.
And the Cajuns, you know, historically are French.
Right.
So it's a French last name. Traditionally, in traditional French, it's Saint-Amand.
Sounds much better.
Yeah. In Cajun, you know, when I go down to Louisiana, which I haven't been since I transitioned for reasons. but, you know, my whole Cajun family would scream, Sanama!
Oh my gosh.
But yeah, I grew up going by Saint Amand because we were in the Midwest and nobody could pronounce it right.
Right.
I've been toying with the fact of going back and just going by Sanamo. But I don't know. That seems pretentious to me now, even though it's how you pronounce my name.
I say go for it. Well, once you start making films and put things out there, you're gonna need to do it for the
Hollywood, the
right? Now presenting Saint-Amand. Have you been back to Kansas? I know you came out, went to your studio there, but like post transitioning and doing some of the physical transitioning, have you been back yet?
Yeah, I did. I've been back a couple times to visit my family. My parents still live there.
Mm-hmm.
And to visit friends. I still have a lot of good friends back home. Good, very supportive people back home. So, I mean, yeah, while I had to close my studio because of people not understanding me, I did have a good support system that I found within Manhattan, Kansas.
Good.
So I go back every now and then. I went back last Christmas. That was the last time. But yeah, I had my bottom surgery in Kansas City.
Okay.
And since my mom is a nurse, I went home and she took care of me during my recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I'm going to have another surgery because that surgery was botched, but mm-hmm. that's a whole nother story.
Yeah. Is that a fairly common thing these doctors are still working on? Like, it is, because I know in the Danish Girl, that was back in the 1920s, but the whole point of it, like, they're like, these surgeries get botched all the time, and is that still like the case?
Well, that's tricky.
Okay.
There are some extremely experienced surgeons who do an incredible job, and their wait lines are long. Their wait lines are long for a reason.
Right.
And I have a whole reasoning on why I went to the surgeons in Kansas City, and I trusted them, and I ultimately got kicked in the ass for it. It's not so, and I don't want to harm their reputation, because they are going to get better at this surgery, and their hearts are in the right place. I genuinely care about the surgical team as people, but they just don't have the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And they just did not do the best job on me.
Yeah.
And there seems to be this atmosphere of kind of just doing an okay job on this procedure with other surgeons, not the surgeons I went to, but just doing an okay job because it's more money for us. We can do this procedure and get them in and out, and you know, it's more money for us.
Yeah.
Rather than people actually caring about the surgeries and actually caring about the procedures, which is why I'm, you know, for my revisions, I'm going to Dr. Marcy Bowers in San Francisco, who is a trans woman. She was the first trans woman to ever do this procedure. And her wait line is extremely long. For my revisions, it's going to be 2 years.
Wow.
If I was to just go to her to start with, 4 years.
Wow.
But she is considered to be the best in the country for this surgery. And there is a reason for that. And part of that is because she is a trans woman herself, and she understands how important
this is for us.
She's probably dedicated her whole professional life to it.
She has.
Yeah.
As far as I know.
Yeah. Wow. Well, we talked over a little bit over an hour and a half. So
wow.
Yeah, that was great.
I can go on and on and on. I know I talk a lot.
I loved it. I thought there was a lot of good information in there.
Thank you all so much for listening. You are all so beautiful and amazing. Make sure to check us out at www.thealphabetmafia.com. You can read our blogs there. You can support our brand. Get a sticker. Get yourself a sticker. That really helps us. It raises brand awareness. You put it on your water bottle. You put it on your laptop. It becomes more of a common thing seen around town. Of course, if you need serious help, you can visit thetrevorproject.org or you can give them a call at 1-866-488-7386. If you are in need of serious help, please reach out to those people immediately. They will be more than happy to help in a tremendous way. Thank you all for tuning in, and I hope you have a beautiful morning, evening, whatever it is. Good night.